Welcome to the Advocate Like a Mother podcast, here to empower and motivate you to use your voice. I'm Andy.
I'm Michelle.
And Ileana just had her baby.
Woo-hoo!
I guess now, though, it's about 2 weeks ago.
Right.
So
when this comes out.
When this comes out.
Yeah.
So by the time, like, it just happened yesterday.
She was
or the
born
day
on
before?
The 12th.
The 12th. Oh, that's so bad. Time flies. It's been 4 days. So that was on the 12th. Congratulate Ileana. Go over to her account and see her new baby, Serafina. What a name.
I know. That's such a pretty... All of her girls have such pretty names.
Such pretty names. So on the show today, we have Lindsay Strickland, founder of Worth the Conversation. And we brought her on because it is Child Abuse Awareness Month. So this conversation kind of balances that dark and light. Granted that, you know, we want to affirm that we need to be talking about this.
Right.
It's worth the conversation. I mean, that's what her organization's really about, right? So, you know, there's a little bit of levity to it. Like, we're able to laugh as we kind of like dialogue about this, but like, we are talking about some heavy stuff, some serious stuff that, you know, there's a part of me that even feels a little bit emotional at certain points, just with like trying to place myself in some of these situations that parents have had to be in that she's referring to, and then trying to imagine myself potentially in that situation. It's just, that's overwhelming for me to think about.
Yeah.
You know?
It's super overwhelming. But, you know, thankfully there's people like Lindsay out there that are taking the charge and, you know, doing the hard work to figure out, you know, ways to prevent abuse and tell us what to do. She's done all the research, and Lindsay's amazing. So I'm excited for you guys to hear this episode.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there's a bunch of wonderful practical material over at her Instagram account and on her website. It's just worththeconversation.com is her website, and then at worththeconversation on her Instagram. You'll hear us plug that a number of times, you know, throughout the next hour, because head over there. Go read it. I mean, it's there's so much to really think about. And that's kind of what you'll get from this episode is, like, if you're like us, you're coming off this thing thinking, why isn't there just like standard guidelines and standard protocols for all of this kind of stuff? And at the end, you'll hear Michelle and I just kind of collapse on the fact of being so upset that there isn't. So, but anyhow, all that to be said, you know, Lindsay shares some wonderful tips of awareness, things that we should be thinking about, and especially questions that we should be asking organizations and as we, you know, hand over the care of our kids, you know, to these folks, whether it's a school, a church, or a care center. And so I hope that after listening to this, you're able to kind of pause and be like, oh, okay, I need a list of questions. You know, I need something that I can kind of go into these places and feel confident and not feel the shame of asking, you know, whoever it is, you know, hey, I just have a few questions I want to ask. It's just to ensure that my child is safe and also that you're safe, that we're able to all kind of have the safest experience that we can have, so, you know, everyone can actually learn or have the experience that they're intended to have in these situations, right?
Yep.
Cool. So, all right. So here we go. Big round of applause if you're in there, wherever you are. If you're driving, don't take your hands off the wheel. give it up for Lindsay Strickland.
Lindsay, thank you so much for joining us today. We're so excited to sit down and talk with you. Why don't you share with us a little bit about yourself and your family, just to kick us off?
Sure. I am thrilled to be here. Always love a conversation with you guys. So this is fun. So I'm Lindsay Strickland. I live in Seattle, Washington with my husband and four kiddos. My girls are 12 and 10, and both of my boys are 8. And my son, who has Down syndrome, his name is Ben, he joined our family through adoption when he was 3. So the boys aren't technically twins, but it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun to call them twins.
Right? So fun. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, just working as a child advocate in a crisis center? Like, how did you become involved in that line of work?
Sure. I think that the seed for it was planted when I was in high school. My family was a foster family, and so I had foster siblings for a few years. And I really think hearing some of their stories probably initially planted the seed to want to work in sexual assault crisis and prevention. And so my professional background was working at a sexual assault crisis center as a child advocate. Wow. And in that role, I did a lot of community education in schools, churches, with youth organizations. And then the big piece, which I really loved the most, was working with families who had a recent disclosure of abuse with one of their children. And so I would come alongside them and help them navigate the court systems, help them find some therapeutic interventions, and really just make sure their voice is heard in the entire really scary process.
Yeah.
And then when you were working, did you come across any children with disabilities, or was it mainly typical children?
You know, it was one of those things that I knew that that population was at a higher risk, but it wasn't something that we were talking about in professional spaces. And because it is harder for children, specifically children who aren't very verbal, to disclose abuse. Well, first of all, it's difficult for any child to share something like that. But especially a child with developmental disabilities, it often goes unreported or underreported. And so I actually never had the opportunity to work directly with a family. A lot of times these cases will stop at the investigation point because it's hard to get evidence to follow through. So that also is part of what has fueled my passion, is just knowing that it is something that is it's overlooked in both the education and prevention spaces, but also in general, it's something that's hard to bring to the courts.
Right. Well, let's take a step back. Tell us about your adoption story and how you came to adopt Ben.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, again, I think the seed was planted just in my experience having foster siblings and just really growing my heart in a way that I, you know, that wouldn't have happened otherwise. And so we knew we wanted to adopt. It was something that we'd always talked about as a way of growing our family. And then our third child had we're still not quite sure. He kind of had a diagnosis of CP, but then it kind of went away, which means it's not CP. Anyway, we don't need to go into all of those details, but he had some neurological differences and had severe speech apraxia. And so that really put our family into this world of medical interventions and special education. And that, again, like, is what I think just really showed me, opened my eyes to this whole new world. And when it seemed like it was time to expand our family again, we decided to check into adoption and found out that there were so many kids, specifically in China, who have Down syndrome or other intellectual disabilities or developmental delays that needed a home. So so that is how Ben came to be.
That's great. And how old was he when you guys adopted him?
He was three.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, adoption is such a loss on so many different levels, but we are, you know, it's such a privilege to be his family. It's just such a privilege. And we did not know that there were such wonderful such a wonderful camaraderie around the special needs community and the Down syndrome community. And so that was a bonus. We had no idea that we would get that with it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I'm curious to know how long did that process kind of take with adopting internationally out of China? Because, yeah, I know there's Down syndrome specifically in China has been a big thing in the adoption space, but I'm kind of curious on, like, what was kind of that duration of time for that process for you?
So it was about a year from start to finish, I guess, from the time we decided to move forward with it. And then from submitting the application, we were traveling about a year later.
Yeah.
It was a very long year of, yeah. We had pictures of him and he was in a wonderful foster center that would post pictures. And so we were able to get a glimpse into his life, which I was thrilled that he was in a place where he was loved, because that's not always the case. But oh my goodness, like seeing those pictures was a gift, but also just made it so hard to not be with him.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Well, tell us a little bit about Worth the Conversation and just how that came to be.
Sure. Well, after we brought Ben home, which was a little over 5 years ago, we really spent that first year trying to bond as a family. And also we were uncovering lots and lots of medical unknowns with him. So just taking care of business, you know, getting stuff done, getting him healthy. But in the back of my mind, the whole time, just my background, knowing that children with developmental disabilities they're at three times a higher risk of experiencing sexual abuse. So knowing that in the back of my mind, I kind of just had this hunch that eventually I would tackle it, eventually. And then I was at a wonderful retreat with a lot of moms who also have little ones with Down syndrome. And I was asking them, you know, do you know of any resources for sexual abuse prevention?
I love it. You saw a need and you filled it. I love that. So let's talk a little bit about just, you know, kind of the foundation you said, like what would you say is laying the foundation for our kids to keep them safe?
Sure. Well, something really basic, and it's so easy for us to overlook, is just to remember to talk to our children about their bodies. Mm-hmm. I think it's easy when you have a child who has some developmental delays to forget that that they are a sexual being. And when we talk about that with children, we're talking about sexual development, learning about their bodies, learning healthy boundaries, and just simple things like teaching your child the correct names for their body parts. Mm-hmm. Is a really easy way to equip them just to understand that their body belongs to them. You know, they are so used to medical interventions, or we have our kids in physical therapy and just a lot of touch from a lot of people. Right. And so just laying that foundation of providing our kids with information and talking to them about their bodies. And it sounds so simple, but it really, really is important.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that what maybe is a little bit challenging for parents to get their head around that is that we think still in a moral binary of, like, you know, good and bad, appropriate, inappropriate. Mm-hmm. And it's like to dialogue about that just feels uncomfortable for those reasons. But with kids in their early developmental age, they don't have that construct about those things. They're just objective words that are just informing what things are.
Yeah, that is such a good point. I mean, and that's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. Just really normalizing our bodies. They're not something to be ashamed of. There are boundaries, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But our bodies alone are not something to be ashamed of. And there is, mm-hmm. in the world of sexual abuse prevention, there can be the language used of good touch and bad touch. And again, like you said, that's one of those binaries. And that's not how it is. You know, there's not a good touch or a bad touch, but there are boundaries that are crossed, and there's inappropriate touch. But yeah, I mean, there's, it's really important to be open and be having these conversations so that if something were to happen, that your child feels comfortable coming to you, and discussing anything.
One of the things that I've noticed that you talk about a lot is secrets versus surprises. Mm. Can you kind of go into that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. You're right. I'm glad you brought this up because this is another big one. And this is something just in your everyday life that you can address. And so abusers will use secrets to manipulate. That's a huge thing in testing a child, seeing if they can keep a secret. So what might start out as an innocent secret can grow into the abuser testing the child's boundaries and seeing what types of secrets they can keep. So in our family, we just don't do secrets at all. There's no reason for secrets. They can hurt people. Even just in, like I said, I have two girls that are 10 and 12. So we've certainly entered the world of whispering and feelings being hurt. And that's just something that's not necessary no matter what. So we like to use surprises in that. Secrets are something that can hurt somebody, but surprises are something that are exciting and fun. They're going to make the person happy. So just even changing your language around that and not allowing secrets in your home. It doesn't have to be a militant thing, but just a family culture of surprises instead of secrets.
I love that. Just the other day, my 16-year-old came up to Eli and she's like, "I have a secret. I love you." And I felt so bad because it was such a sweet moment. But I'm like, "Oh, honey, well, we can't say that to him." And like, and I explained to her why, and she totally got it. But it's just so funny how like in our culture, that's just such like secrets is just, you know, we don't think of it as what it could lead to, but it's so important to have these conversations and
You know? And that was such an innocent and sweet thing, and so often that is what it is, you know. But and it can be hard to tell grandparents or family members, you know, or anybody who's well-intentioned. But just like you said, like as soon as you bring it to somebody's attention, they usually totally get it. You know, right. and they want to be part of the solution, not the problem.
Right.
Yeah. It's as you're talking too, I'm now like kind of deconstructing some of my language in my head of like, okay. Cause I mean, I'm not really using like secretive language in anywhere, but I'm like, well, what other words are out there that help better like explain the things that we're going after a lot of the time, you know? Cause like, I think the way the word secret is used, like with kids and the way we think is like, it's that play on being mischievous, but it's supposed to be playful and it's not supposed to be harmful, right? But it's like, then there's lots of other things I feel like in our culture that lend towards that. But in a way I'm like, well, I don't think we use the word treasure as often. And I think that's kind of like a cute word, you know, it's like, cause we can treasure something that we keep to ourselves that like, not everyone has to know about it, you know, but like there's some things we want that like, I hold this near and dear and I have to kind of protect it. It has its own boundary. It has its own space, but there's kind of a beauty also in treasure where treasure also is meant to be found, you know? So there's kind of like that adventure of like, you know, I'm just kind of vamping on that for a minute. And I think that's kind of,
I love that. I think I'm going to start using that because you're right. There are sacred things and you're allowed to hold those things close. But you're right with the intention that, a treasure, something to hold close, but being found out is, It's something that brings you joy. Yeah,
because like to just what you just said, Michelle, I mean, it would have been cute if it was like, I have a treasure for you and this is what it is. It's like, oh, that's like, well, that's like, that sounds really exciting. You know, that's kind of, you know, it means you've found something and you've kept it and then you now revealed it as like this big thing. I'm like, that's cool. Like, that's really neat. So
anyways, I like that. I really like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, that's good. I hadn't heard anybody talk about it that way. That's good. Write a little book about that one.
Oh man, you know, this interview is going to be interesting for people to listen to, because it's, I think there's this balanced levity of like, we have to find ways that we could talk about this stuff, mm-hmm. because it is an uncomfortable conversation. It is a heavy conversation, right? And you know, I appreciate you ladies of being able to like, you know, hold that levity, and we can laugh, because I mean, some of my questions here are hard, you know. It's just like, ah, yeah, you know, like I want to go from what we just talked about and then ask you, like, you know, what do you consider, you know, some of the most, you know, like what's the most dangerous situation, you know, that we should be aware of that might be unexpected, you know, to a child, mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. you know, like, what does that look like?
Sure, sure. Well, I have to say, like you said, the importance of levity. My kids are like, oh, are you going to talk about private parts again? So they're just, just, yeah, mom, okay, you know. And when they started to do the sort of pre-sex education in schools, they're like, you're going to be so excited. This is what we talked about today. They're talking about consent and that sort of thing. Oh. So yeah, it is important. And you can do that in a family. You can address it with some levity, you know. But, yeah. But thank you for asking the hard questions too.
Yeah.
Well, I would say some of the situations that should set off some alarm bells in a parent's mind. The language I use is also parent, but we're talking about any person in a caregiver role. Teachers, and you know, babysitters, anybody who loves a child. One of the main things that should set off some red flags is if there is somebody in your child's life who you see are really trying to get them into isolated situations, and just sort of might have a general disrespect for your boundaries with your child. Mm-hmm. And we do know that the majority, statistics will say 90%, some say 95% to 99% of abusers are somebody that the family does know and trust. Somebody who's really put in the work to gain the trust of the family. And so even that can feel really scary, thinking, okay, it's somebody who might be in my life. It's somebody who we see all the time. But if you take the time to inform yourself and learn about it, you will be able to see those red flags. And like I said, a big one is somebody who might try to get your child into an isolated situation, one-on-one situation. Again, going back to the secrets, you know, somebody who might be showing such special interest in your child that it might appear to be cutesy little things between the two of them. But if they're, if their motivation is relationship with your child and not necessarily with you as a team member to a team of adults who love your child, but somebody who is so honed in just on your child, that would be another red flag. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do those make sense at all?
Yeah, because we're speaking very situationally. So it's like now, like, obviously those situations are going to play out in different environments, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, which will kind of lead me to my next question. Like, we often are, you know, either dropping off our kids at school, we're dropping them off at a Sunday school class, we're dropping them off at a caregiver or a babysitter or a, you know, a family friend or an aunt or an uncle to babysit or whatever it be. But as a way, like, you know, so those, you know, those perpetrators and those predators are out there, right? And they make their way into these spaces and they coerce and they cheat. And the thing is, they, you know, these folks make their ways into a lot of these spaces when we don't know it, but which kind of leads me to this question, like, what are the kinds of questions that we should be asking our schools and our churches and our care centers in order to ensure that we're leaving our kids in the best, you know, and safest care? Like, I think we're quick to trust and be like, well, you exist. Obviously, I can just leave my kid with you. Mm-hmm. But I mean, is that a little bit too careless? I mean, what kind of information should we be looking for to make sure that we feel comfortable, you know, especially with the kid, you know, with the disability?
Sure. Yeah. It's easy to assume that child care settings, schools, churches, the places you named, camps, that they would have already thought of this and they would have safety protocols in place. But I have found that that is not necessarily the situation. Staff hasn't been educated. people may not know or likely don't know the protocols. And so really simply asking, you know, what protocols do you have around one-on-one with kids? What are your bathroom protocols? If you were to suspect some type of abuse, like how does your organization handle that? And are you going to believe the child when they say something? Or will you respect the parent when they're asking these questions? And I mean, I still have a hard time asking this because I never want anybody to think that I don't appreciate them or that I think they're ill-intentioned, because I really value the team that we have around my son. But it is important to ask. And one example, when my daughter, who's now 12, when she was 3 years old and we were starting a new preschool, we just moved to Seattle, and I'm from Virginia, so it felt, you know, we're in the big city now. And my first child, and given my background, you know, I'm Mama Bear who's asking the questions, but still a really new mom, you know, so still not totally sure of myself. And I did ask her new preschool what their bathroom policy was, and they didn't have one. And they had both female and male teachers, and they had absolutely no protocols in place for adults taking children to the bathroom, because three-year-olds need help in the potty, you know? And they had no protocols in place, but they were incredibly receptive, did not shame me at all, which I'm so thankful for. And they put some protocols in place. And actually since then I've heard of other friends whose kids have gone through that little preschool, and now they talk about it openly. And so, you know, that feels good to know that I, just by asking a few questions, was able to set up a safer environment for the future.
Right.
And I know not everybody is going to be met with such openness, because there can be a defensiveness. But perhaps that would be a red flag as well. Some defensiveness about safety.
Right. So yeah. our guest that we had on last week, her son was being abused at school. And she went to the school, and basically because of, you know, they wanted to protect themselves and their liability, you know, now the person who is abusing her son is walking free. And so, you know, what, you know, if a parent suspects abuse is happening at the school, you know, what do you suggest a parent do in that situation?
Goodness. Yeah, that is so hard. Well, one thing I like to suggest, if you ever have suspicions of abuse, is to let people know that you can always call your local child protective service agency. They're called different things in different areas of the country, but they would be the ones to investigate a situation. And that can feel scary to make that phone call. But what you can do is call with a scenario. You can do it anonymously and just ask them, you know, how would you handle this? This is the information that I have. This is what I suspect. What would an investigation into this matter look like? So that can feel like a difficult call to make, like you're turning in somebody to the police, and maybe I don't have enough information. Maybe I don't, you know, but ultimately what you're doing is setting up the professionals to come in, to ask the right questions. Not all places, but thankfully a lot of places have a child-centered and family-centered approach now. It's not everybody's experience. But that's why it's really important to go straight to Child Protective Services and let them know the situation. And like I said, you can do that anonymously at first, and that can be kind of a good baby step just to help build up your confidence and decision and going forward.
Yeah, that's really good. I feel like I keep hearing consistently, and even beyond child abuse stories, I mean, in areas of other forms of sexual harassment and abuse in organizations and institutions where, you know, it's brought up to the institution first, mm-hmm. you know, so then it's like all of a sudden they, you know, they launch their own investigation because like, well, if as long as we find it, then we'll validate it. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, well, oh, we got our lawyer to come in and they're going to investigate. And it's just like, you know, and I said this on the last show, it's like, right. And they're investigating their liability, you know, mm-hmm. to see if yeah, like that's, exactly. you know, what's going to happen if it's actually true. And so that's where, like, I really hope folks listening hear this and hear this well. Like, it's hard because I'm sitting here feeling that tension of, like, for whatever reason, our culture, the way that it is, the shame that we feel if we have to, like, even ask the question and we mm-hmm. have to even go through those steps to make those phone calls is a tragedy on its own. We shouldn't even ever feel that way. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we do, you know, unfortunately, you can't, I hate to say, we just can't trust the institutions anymore on that level. Mm-hmm. It's just like you have to bring in those outside authorities first. And like, I'm glad that you said, like, you know, take a baby step and kind of take an anonymous approach, maybe, you know, to kind mm-hmm. of like let them, like, you know, poke around a little bit and see if like they pull any red flags. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as you need to, I guess, launch a full investigation or whatever you need to disclose after that. But I really hope folks hear that. Like, mm-hmm. This isn't like to, you know, you're in the back of your mind, you might be saying, no, but my school's the best. They would never do that. I know I can work with them if I think something's happening. It's like, this isn't, I don't know the people you're talking about and there's no personal questions there. It's like, I'm really thinking like for your kid, like, organizations and institutions go through a great amount of risk to protect themselves. And I really just don't become that victim, you know?
Absolutely.
It's like, that's where we have to like really advocate, I think, is like saying like, no, sorry, like this is where it's happening. I'm not going to go to where it's happening to ask them, are you doing this to my child? Like, right. I think we've learned so much about abuse mm-hmm. in so many spaces that I'm just really hoping that people hear there's a different way to do this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yes, having a neutral third party to be the one yeah. to dive in and figure out what's going on is so important. And there are some great organizations that do that. I mean, clearly Child Protective Services and, you know, going the legal route is very important. But there's an organization called Grace that helps church, is a third party that can go into churches to help them sort through these types of issues as well. So that is one that I highly recommend. And there are others out there as well. But yeah, it is so important not to handle it in-house. For everybody's sake, it is very important not to handle it in-house.
I'm so glad you said that. Thank you, Lindsay, for making that clear. Because as you were saying it, like, I almost started feeling emotional about these things, of like feeling that cultural pressure and that mm-hmm. like that shame of like, all I want to do is stand up for my kid when I think something is going wrong. But now I'm worried about being seen a certain way to those like I have, like, you know, relationships with, whatever it's, you know, family members or people in the school or whatever it is. But like, you know, what would you say, what cultural perceptions do we need to adjust in order to like embrace the reality that that abuse does take place and it is taking place, especially with, you know, in the disabilities community? You know, maybe there's teachers and caregivers listening that might be the people that have to be approached, you know, by families to kind of say like, hey, like, you know, what, if we're saying to everybody else out there, you know, beyond the parents, like, what kind of posture can you suggest they take when, if you lead an organization and you're being asked these questions, like, what should be the first things we run through our mind instead of just like defense, you know, instead of like
sure.
protect the institution,
absolutely.
Right? It's like, cause we assume yeah. that they have the kid's best interest in mind, but a lot mm-hmm. of times most people have their own, you know, survival in mind. I don't want to get fired. I don't want my institution to fail because now this thing you're saying could be crippling to my organization if it's mm-hmm. true, mm-hmm. you know? So I think that's kind of, you know, I think that's what I'm looking for. Like, what advice might you give to that person who's
sure.
like, hey, you're being approached with an accusation. Like, let's take that seriously, but how do we do that well?
Well, and oftentimes too, there's a fear of smearing somebody's good name. Oh, this is an upstanding member of our community, which people often are, who are abusing children. You know, somebody charismatic and well loved, and people want to protect them, protect their institution, protect themselves. I would say always remember that nobody wants to talk about their sex life. Nobody want, and a child who does not have a sex life, that's not what I'm, but something that is so embarrassing or private, they're not going to make it up. They're not going to lie about it unless they have some base of knowledge, which would also be abuse if somebody is talking to them about these sort of things. This is not something that victims can make up, especially a child. And so I would encourage anybody listening to this to just, if your gut reaction is to push against it, just take a step back and remember who we're talking about and what we're talking about. And it always, 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 the response needs to be focused on the victim, always, and what is going to be in their best interest. And like you were saying, Andy, so often institutions jump to protecting the abuser and therefore protecting themselves. And so really just taking a step back, taking a deep breath and thinking through, what is this accusation and how could a child even make this up? Which is so simple, but I think we forget that. We had a situation in the community that we lived in a few years ago where a very well-loved youth pastor was accused of something that had happened quite a while ago, was brought up, and he ended up being convicted. But man, I tell you what, sitting in that courtroom supporting the survivor, who is an amazing, amazing woman, just the line of questioning that she had to go through, and seeing that people from adults from her church community when she was a teenager sitting on the abuser's side, you know, and listening to the graphic details that she had to share and still sitting on his side of the courtroom. I didn't have words. I was very proud to be on her side. But yeah, these things divide a community, and it's mind blowing. It's mind blowing that what people are willing to overlook in order to save somebody's reputation.
Yeah.
When they've destroyed somebody's life. Yeah.
Right. I had a similar situation happen when I was younger. Our youth pastor was sexually abusing several boys that I knew in our grade. And it was basically just like a slap on the wrist. He lost his job. And, you know, back then we didn't have social media, so we didn't really know what happened to him. And a few years later, I went to another church that's like in the same, I guess, like denomination, I guess you could call it.
Association.
Yeah. And there he is. He's on staff at that church. He just moved churches.
Yes. Yep.
That's all they did.
Yep, exactly.
They just moved him to another church. And I don't think he was a youth pastor, but he was still a pastor.
Yeah.
And it was just, it's sickening.
And
it's
where so are the sickening. Adults?
Right.
Where are the adults?
Right.
Why is it that the children who are victimized have to grow up and handle this? Yeah. Where are the adults? You know? Right. So yeah, that is what I would say to everybody. Be an adult. It is our job to keep kids safe. It is our job to see these red flags and speak up. It's not the child's job to have their story straight and to know all the details. It is, it's our job as the adults to step in and ask questions.
Yeah, I know. Cause I know when I'm asking that question, like it seems like the answer is obvious. Like, well, yeah, think like take the child seriously, like, take, you know, take the story seriously. But that's just it, is like the fact that we have to verbalize this stuff out loud and say, like, be an adult and see that there's like a human being we're talking about here. Like, that the importance of that human's life far outweighs, you know, the importance of the institution. Now, granted, the argument's going to be like, well, but if this thing failed, think of all the lives it affects. But it's just like, my goodness, it's like, but if that's like your thinking and your binary, that, yes, red flag, you know. And so you know, again, like that, it falls in with all of that. Well, I want to you know, kind of turn back a little bit of levity here, and like, thank you for offering all of those thoughts on how we could be more aware, and like maybe what we should do about, you know, some of those situations. But you know, since you've started your work with Worth the Conversation, you know, share with us some of the progress, or maybe some of the unexpected positive stories that have come from that. I mean, I think what you shared about even just asking about bathroom protocols has now turned into like, hey, this is something that they openly talk about now, and it was kind of haphazard. I think being educated, I think for us, like, if you're going to ask the question, now you also end up being the educator. You know, that's going to all be part of
exactly.
That's going to end up going hand in hand. But yeah, but yeah, share with us at least like some of the progress that you've seen that you could share that might encourage people to say, you know, let's take this on together. We need to, you know, we got to look out for each other, and we got to see some progress here if it's that bad.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I just have to say, the Down syndrome community has opened up this conversation with open arms. Like, it has been such an encouragement to see that parents were fearful about this. You know, it's not that they didn't know that this was an issue, but they didn't know how to address it. And so I'm just so grateful for the response, and that gave me the confidence to keep moving forward. And this past year has really thrown us all for a loop. So having four kids at home, not a lot of some of my dreams and visions for how to really get the word out there has necessarily happened. But I've had organizations come forward who, you know, want to partner and want to bring this to their local communities. And so really thinking through the best way to do that to them, because really it's again, it's in the title, it's in the name, it's just about having conversations. Yeah, I'm thinking through the best way to keep spreading the word while having kids kind of not really at school. But one thing that I've really had to, like you said, when, you know, you're the one who asked the question, then my feet have been put to the fire, and I've really had to practice what I preach and think through how this all plays out in my role as a parent, of Ben. You know, one of the big things is the IEPs. You know, I know you guys talk a lot about, your listeners are not a stranger to IEP meetings. And so in the past few years, I've brought up the safety stuff in IEP meetings and have found that Ben's IEP team, while there's a few deer in headlights looks, in general, everybody's really open to it. And so, open to talking about safety and to talking about how to avoid the one-on-one situations and making a bathroom safety protocol. So I have found, as I get DMs or emails asking me the hard questions about this type of thing, I have to put it into practice. So I'm still learning too, and I'm learning a lot. I'm learning a lot from people, and I'm really thankful for people reaching out and just seeing that there was such a need. And I want to keep learning the ways that Worth the Conversation can help meet those needs.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Hey, can you tell us a little bit about what a prevention partner is?
Well, I'm in process of figuring that out. But yes, there is. My hope is really to create some material. And I mean, a lot of it is already on the website. It's just putting it in a nice, convenient package where parents or people involved in their local Down syndrome organizations. And again, I really focus on Down syndrome because that is the world that I'm in. But so much of this, if not all of it, you know, transfers over to all children, and especially all children with any sort of developmental disability. But yeah, I would love to for people to reach out to talk about how we can partner and how we can start some conversations in local communities, because there are such specific needs going on. You know, everybody has their story of something tough that's happened in their community. And so being able to be in specific conversation about brainstorming ways to handle that. And I would love to do that. So yeah, things are in progress. Always have these ideas spinning.
Yeah.
And love to hear what people need too. So as I get material rolling out, the most important thing is to meet people's needs.
So just kind of in closing, what would you, if you could summarize, like what would you say the top three ways to prevent sexual abuse of our kids is?
Oh goodness. Okay. So, so I think having open family communication, not being scared to talk about your child's body with them. And then understanding, who abuses, that it's not stranger danger that we're looking at here, but, these are, people who are making calculated, manipulated attempts to desensitize the whole family in order to abuse. What was that? Two?
Yeah, those two.
I think especially for our children with intellectual disabilities, consistency, repetition, in boundaries. So simple things like, you know, a 10-year-old doesn't need to be sitting on their teacher's lap, you know, at school, like just really age appropriate boundaries that will carry over into the rest of your child's life. I know parents are worried about romantic relationships in the future, or even, you know, even just friendships. Boundaries can be really, really hard for our kids. So I think starting early and helping them understand personal boundaries, that if, you know, if they don't want to give somebody a hug, they don't have to. Little things like knocking before you go into the bathroom. I mean, it sounds so silly, but the repetition and the consistency, I think, really does pay off in helping just ingrain it being boundaries, being a healthy part of their life.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Lindsay, like for everything that you're doing. Our kids really are worth the conversation. And I just really appreciate just the work you're doing and just creating, you know, awareness around this and, you know, just helping us as a community just know how to address these issues. For our listeners, how can they follow you and support you?
Sure. So you can find a lot of practical information and tips, book recommendations at worththeconversation.com. And then I'm also on Instagram. I'm on other social media as well, but most active on Instagram. And that's just at worththeconversation. And yeah, I'm excited to be launching some new stuff. And so keep your eyes out. And also have a newsletter. And the intention that it will go out monthly just to update on latest happenings and ways to get involved and support.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Lindsay. We'll see you later.
Bye. Bye.
All right, Michelle. I'm so happy that Lindsay took the time with us for Child Abuse Awareness Month here in April with her organization, Worth the Conversation. I'm so glad that she's doing what she's doing.
Yeah.
You know,
super thankful for her.
Seriously. It's like, I won't go into too much detail, but I mean, even just recently, like, you know, something happened in a class with us that was just like, okay, hold on. We need to ask more questions, you know, cause like in realizing also like, did we talk about this in our IEP or did we talk to the teachers about any of these circumstances that we prefer based on like, you know, however, she's cared for in different situations. And we realized that it was like, we hadn't really gone that far and went that specific. So, so many good reminders for what she said. And as I mentioned on the show, just having heard so many stories of abuse in institutions and all this stuff, right. I'm like, man, get a third party involved, get a neutral third party involved. Like,
for sure.
it just seems so proven that it's like, that is how we're supposed to be doing it.
Right. And going back to the IEP thing. So I don't even know how I knew, but when we had Eli's IEP for his school, I did ask about stuff like that. And I don't even know why that was on my radar, but it was. And so I asked about their bathroom protocol and they had an answer immediately. And so it's interesting to hear Lindsay's story of Ben's IEP and that, you know, or was it just at a daycare? Is that what it was? I can't remember.
Well, I think she had two examples. She said to a couple different, she's found that in bringing up an IEP meetings, like they're a little bit deer in the headlights, but then they're willing to talk about it because safety is important to them. So it feels like a new conversation for them, but they're kind of like caught off guard, but like, yes, let's talk about that. And then she also said that, yes, I think she said at her church that she, like a church that they first started going to at their new spot in Washington, she had brought it up and they didn't have the protocols. And I think she said since then other parents that have gone or have said that now they openly share about it or talk about it or whatever. Yeah.
I think it's just like eye-opening to me that, you know, why don't we have just across the board, just state or federal laws in place to protect kids against sexual abuse? Like, it just seems like a no-brainer to me. You know, we have protocols for what would happen if there's an earthquake. What would happen, sadly, if there's an active shooter? You know, we have all these scenarios to keep kids safe, except for sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. Why don't schools just have, these are our protocols. This is what we do. No males taking kids to the bathroom alone.
Yeah.
You know, it just simple things. Like, why don't we have that?
Yeah, I agree. Times have changed, you know? I mean, and I don't know. And it's hard. Like, it seems to me that there was an era before the last 50 years that people were more trusting and that these did either A, crimes weren't being reported as often and they were happening just as often, or B, or it actually just didn't happen as often. and if it didn't happen as often, it makes me wonder why, you know, I guess I'm not surprised that it's happening more. There's more people in the world. There's more social, you know, experiences. So I'm not surprised that we know more about it and that it happens more. But to your point, then why don't we have that level of protocol guidelines? And I think that gets complex. I think that becomes a matter of policy and politics, where it's like, how much should the government have say on, like, you know, XYZ guidelines? I mean, of course, we know with the education system, we've got like four different versions of education. We've got private, we got public, we got charter, and like obviously there's a mix of all of that. And I'm absolutely with you. Like, yes, and plus churches and denominations and all of that complexity and like their own associations and their own guidelines and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then of course you end up with this giant narrative of like, well, then by somehow putting these protocols in place, we're violating our freedom.
Right.
So it's like, if you could see my big reaction in that moment, how frustrating that sometimes that becomes the response and what it's boiled down to, that like, well, that's a violation of my freedom. And it's just like, my goodness, these are people we're talking about. These are human beings we're talking about. And so I don't know. And I so badly wish that, yes, like there could be blanket things put in place that just across the board, you know, at least put this level of protection in. It's some form of a safety net. And obviously it's not, people are going to get through. And that's the sad part that with this is that my concern is not only all of that. My concern is also though, why? What is also taking place in our culture that is creating more predators? You know, and so that's, it's like we have to be willing to try to figure that out as well.
Yeah.
You know,
because it boils down to hurt people. It's a cycle of abuse. They were probably abused, and not that that makes it okay or anything, but it's usually what happens. You know, you get hurt as a child and then you don't go through trauma therapy or get healing. I know, you know, Lindsay brought that up, you know, about. And it just, you know, just so many people are shamed and then they keep that secret hidden. You can't heal what you don't uncover and reveal. And so they keep it hidden and then more trauma. It's just a horrible cycle.
Yeah. Well, folks, I know we're kind of leaning towards, you know, a bit of a charter topic. You know, it goes and you know, again, I want to thank both Michelle and Lindsay, I think, for having a gentle voice and a gentle spirit as we kind of have talked about all of this. I think as a dad and all of this too, I and there's a lot of mama bears out there, so by no means is this a gender comment, but it's just like I personally just feel this like overwhelming like burn of protection just like fuming inside of me, because I'm just like, I can't tolerate this stuff, you know. And but we become the educators, and so I hope that this has been a helpful conversation for you guys. Go support Lindsay, you know, where she's at with Worth the Conversation. Check out all of her resources. You know, do what you can to share a little bit about what's going on this month with Child Abuse Awareness Month. I know when this comes out, it's the last week of the month, but again, you know, pick up the torch, and you know, all of us here advocating for our kids, advocating for each other in this great community. So thanks again to Lindsay, and thank all of you for joining us today.
Bye.
Thanks again for listening. As always, if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, we'd appreciate it, and share this episode with a friend. Access resources, episode notes, podcast merch, and more at www.advocatelikeamother.org. And if you're a company looking to partner with us via sponsorship, please reach out to us on our website. And lastly, follow us on Instagram at advocatelikeamother and join our community group on Facebook. Friends, we'll see you next time.